Here's to the finest crew in Starfleet.
Engage.
Captain Jean-Luc Picard, the USS Enterprise.
Commander Benjamin Sisko, Federation Starbase, Deep Space Nine.
Welcome to The Greatest Generation. It's a Star Trek podcast by a couple of guys who are a little bit embarrassed about having a Star Trek podcast. I'm Adam Pranica.
I'm Ben Harrison.
Voice a little gravelly today.
Ooh.
Hope that's not foreshadowing anything.
God, I was just at the post office. I was there thinking, oh, maybe I'll... I had a thing I had to mail. Thought I may maybe pick up stuff from the mailbox, do a little mailbag marin, but there were, it was all like package slips, and I stood in the wrong line, and then by the time I was made aware of what the right line to stand in for my packages was, the post office was full of people. Nobody was social distancing. I got freaked out and I left, and I was like, I bet I caught it in there. I bet that was it. But I've had that feeling like 25 times since this started, so.
We've backslid majorly. We're recording this episode in early July.
Yeah.
Things are not looking great at this point. I hope future Ben and Adam remain healthy and well as all the rest of our friends of DeSoto.
Yeah, we can't afford to have friends of DeSoto catch this thing.
Just as you've been stuck in a post office line, I've been 2 days in a row now, Ben. I've been in line at the DMV, bailed both times.
I thought you got kicked out one of the times.
I was kicked out one of the times, not for anything I did, but because...
Not for cause.
I was there in the early afternoon. It was like, I don't know, 1 or 2. The office closed at 5. They got on the PA and they were like,
yeah, they gave an appointment. It's not happening today.
And I was very grateful for the message. It saved me several hours and then the awful realization of wasting those hours for nothing. And then I went back. I woke up bright and early this morning, went back this morning. The line was double the length that it was yesterday.
Everybody from yesterday came back.
Nobody's got time for that.
No, it's a strange and stressful time to be alive.
My license has been expired now for a couple of days. My out-of-state plates, tabs are expired.
I'm
illegal in every vehicular way.
I was talking to my wife because I related some of your DMV issues to her, and I was asking her if she thought that I would be going as nuts as you are in this if the same situation had befallen me.
Because you're such a rule follower. You don't want to live the way I'm living.
You're less of a rule follower, but you're more type A. You hate an unchecked box.
Fucking A, man.
More than anyone I know.
That is incredibly insightful. I was in a super pissy attitude earlier today because for some reason... I chose working on a kitchen project over doing show research in my hierarchy. And by the time I finished up in the kitchen, I had very little time to do the tasks assigned to me for my job being this show. And I was super angsty and pissy, and I was like short with my wife and stuff. Like, I'm such an idiot. I box myself into these corners. And then I lash out at the world.
Yeah, and she's like, what's up your ass?
For my many mistakes.
And you're like, my boss, Ben Harrison, is going to be so mad at me.
I'm so stupid.
I don't get mad. I get even, Adam.
If I got even on myself, I would be dead a long time ago.
Yeah, if I had a boss, I would have been dead a long time ago.
Right. Luckily, you've just got me, Ben.
Yeah.
And I am backwards hat, backwards chair. Backwards pants, kind of cool.
Party in the front, party in the back. You're a chill boss. You're a good guy to work for, Adam.
Try to be. And you walk all over me for it.
You know who we really work for, though, is the friends of DeSoto who support the show.
That's right.
And depending on whether or not the network pulls the plug again or whatever, this is the Max Fun Drive.
Yeah, I feel like you or I have said those words dozens of times over the last few weeks.
Yeah, we...
Maybe this is the time that it'll stick.
It was supposed to be end of Q1 kind of timing, like March, I think, was the first attempted scheduling of the Max Fun Drive, and then it was rescheduled and then canceled again. This is all behind the scenes. They probably don't want us to let people know that this happened.
They don't listen to this show. It's fine.
But this is the third attempt, and this is actually the first episode we've recorded since we found out. So, and I think that this, if I'm looking at the calendar right, this will be the last episode of the Max Fun Drive for The Greatest Generation. So thanks to everyone that has contributed so far, and if you haven't yet, this is your last week to do it, so do it.
Our myriad friends of DeSoto have risen up in support of us. Feels good.
Feels great.
Did I ever tell you a friend of mine confused that word with Miriam? He was like, he casually was like, you know, there are Miriam examples of this. And I think it was in a workplace context. And I was like, what the fuck? How could you live your entire life calling it Miriam?
That is pretty
I'm sure
amazing.
There are dozens of examples of words I fucked up on this very show.
Yeah.
That are worse offenses than that, but it's always stuck with me. Every time I've said the word myriad, I've thought Miriam.
I really like it. we have a dear friend named Miriam. I'm gonna tell her about that. She'll be delighted.
Yeah, tell her that her name was an embarrassing moment for a coworker of mine. They'll love that. You know, speaking of embarrassing workplace incidents. Mm. Boy, do we have the episode for you. If you like that kind of thing.
Yeah. Let's get into it, Adam. It's season 6, episode 25 of Star Trek Deep Space Nine, The Sound of Her Voice.
Do you realize how incredible this is? No, of course you don't.
Ben, I feel like we could do a tight 20 on what I'm going to call the core question of the entire episode.
Mm.
Gets it out of the way in the cold open.
Yeah.
Are you a backless barstool or an unbacked barstool guy?
I kind of disagreed with Odo on this. I think that a back on a barstool is asking for you to lean back in a way that is actually dangerous because your center of gravity is too high.
Nonsense.
So I would go backless personally.
Have you tipped over and fallen out of a bar stool before? It sounds like you speak from experience.
I have not. I had a friend do it once, but I caught him because he had been in this bar for a couple hours before I got there. And when I came in, he did this thing where he, like, instead of turning around, he leaned his head all the way backward to where he was, like, looking at me over back of his shoulders, and he tipped over.
Shattering his upper vertebra or puncturing 3 or 4 of his lungs.
I had to catch him. And part of this was that he was soused, and
that'll happen.
Part of it was that the stool was not bolted to the floor.
There is a bar in Portland. I don't think they would be insulted by this characterization. That is just a fucking dive. I fucking love this bar. It's called Claudia's. One of the notable things about Claudia's is that it has the highest bar stools ever. Like the highest bar stool backs. They're like Dracula collars. They're like,
whoa.
They rise like a foot or two above your head. And they swivel, you know? It's like a private booth.
Wow.
It's great.
And they're at the bar?
Yeah.
That's got to be a strong discouragement for second and third row ordering.
Yeah, I would say so. God, there's also like 13 Coins in Seattle also has like the diner style bar stool with like a nice leather back.
Mm-hmm.
You can get cozy in and swivel in. But I think, once again, I think those are bolted to the floor. I think whether or not you're bolted is a major part of what back you choose.
This is all in service of some very traditional Odo on Quark legalistic harassment. Odo is just making a nuisance of himself in Quark's bar, applying red tape wherever he can. Jake is also present for some reason.
Why he's there, the reasons are nil, because for some reason, Jake Sisko.
It's me, Jake.
I think at this point he's just journalizing, but eventually we come to understand that he's been written in the episode as a guy who's taken an interest in Quark because he's writing about a criminal mastermind or something, and is going is using his time in Quark's Bar as research.
I have a deeply uncomfortable question to pose to you, Ben. Is for some reason Jake a fail son?
You're asking if he's like a Kudé Hussein?
I want to believe in a future where, you know, artists' lives are respected as being, you know, equal to any other kind of career, and that it's like rewarded and good and rewarding to the artist. But I don't think we're given the sense that he's good at this or anyone else likes what he's doing.
This is just character research.
Right.
And for some reason, Jake is given respect and patience because he's Ben Sisko's son, but I would have hoped and expected by the end of season six that we would like him and respect him for his own character's reasons. And I don't know if we're there yet with him. He doesn't seem to be self-actualized in any way.
The unlearned lesson of Wesley Crusher.
Wesley, the boy.
The boy. Young Wesley Crusher.
My son.
Was it doesn't serve a Star Trek show to write a character in that is like about to go to college, because it becomes like the least interesting will they won't they. Mm-hmm. Like, is this kid gonna go off to college or not? And yeah. I think that the writers are like, well, on the one hand, we don't want to write this character off the show because we find utility in telling stories with this character, and on the other hand, we are setting this character up to be a fail son by having him stall out and mope around the station like a ghost because he doesn't have any ambition in life.
Failure to launch.
In order to enjoy it, this episode makes you accept the idea that Quark would want, for some reason, Jake around.
Out of courtesy to Nog, Quark is tolerating Jake's presence and also kind of giving him some play-by-play on his thought process, because what happens here is in the midst of Odo's ball busting, Kira comes in, gives Odo a zup, and Odo's mood changes. He makes himself scarce, and in this, Quark sees an opportunity. He now knows how to play Odo like a fiddle.
I've got to admit, I've come around to the Odo-Kira relationship. I don't like seeing how gooey Odo gets when Kira enters a room, but I like seeing her this happy. It's nice. She just lights up.
Yeah, she is giving us like NRE vibes with how excited she is to see Odo.
Pretty radiant.
Yeah. Speaking of girlfriends, Adam, on the Little D, Cassidy Yates is serving as a liaison officer. You know, they're like doing that thing that you do sometimes in World War II where you have to escort a bunch of merchant marine vessels across the Atlantic. Little D is on escort duty, and Cassidy Yates has been given the task of liaising with those merchants. And she's complaining about how much paperwork this new job entails.
I knew there was a reason why I didn't join Starfleet. I couldn't do this paperwork.
And Dr. Bashir comes in complaining about how much paperwork his job entails.
Smart.
Seems like Starfleet's just a bunch of pencil-pushing cheese dicks.
I think the thing that you don't want to have when you invite a friend or family member to a workplace thing is to have them relate to you how boring your shit is. And that's kind of the effect here, right?
Yeah.
Like, they're having a hang. This is the last thing that Ben Sisko wants to hear.
And he's like sitting there with like a pile of pads in front of him. He's like in the throes of paperwork when she comes in to complain about paperwork. You are not helping, Cassidy.
It introduces a tension right away between Sisko and Cassidy that pervades the rest of the episode.
Looks like you did a pretty good job.
And I think it is very well played. I definitely feel it.
Mm-hmm. He gets called up to the bridge by Worf because they're getting a distress call from the Rotharian sector. And he says, Worf, is that the ship that General Martok commands? What are you talking about? He said, no. Rotharian, not Rotaran.
Worf takes out his retainer and then he says it again. Like, oh, I see.
Oh, I get you. It's a general distress signal, and it's very broken up, but he gets up to the bridge, and they give it a listen. And it's a lady describing a very harrowing escape from a ship getting destroyed. Her escape pod is torn open. She landed on a Class L planet, which is, it's not Class M, but it's not Class D, you know. You could live on it.
Yeah. Class L is class live, like bare bones, mm-hmm. livability. Yeah. Class L.
It's not Class T, which is class thrive.
I'm standing next to this planet. I'm slapping it on the atmosphere. It's pretty basic, but it'll get you there.
It's like a used planet you buy from a rental, you know, company. You know, yeah. Like they buy specifically like the bottom end of the trim package for everything. Yeah. Cloth interior, no XM radio. Like everything is just like the bottom of the line.
Crank windows.
I didn't even know they still made that.
The complaints start right away about this planet. Captain Lisa, not happy with her circumstances, suggests that she may be in some trouble in pretty short order unless someone can rescue her on the double.
Any other ships closer to that sector? No, sir.
And that's when the little D throws it in gear and heads her way.
They are 6 days away from this planet at maximum warp. This is a real haul. And So, unfortunately, even though their mission is over, their suffering is just beginning.
It gives you the idea of how thin the fleet is spread, because the idea of any ship being 6 days away from another at this moment in time is kind of a scary prospect, right?
Totally. If the little D's away, does Deep Space Nine just have its pants around its ankles until it gets back? Or is there another ship taking on that job for the time being?
The main thing about having your pants around your ankles is how slowly you move, because your ankles are caught in those pants.
yeah, you can't get around a full stride.
No.
It's a bit like having flippers on your feet, you know?
It is, in the same way that it's easier to walk backwards with pants around your ankles than it is forwards. Here's the thing about walking in flippers, you're not supposed to walk in them, and you're not supposed to turn your back on a wave, so how exactly are you supposed to walk around on a beach?
Yeah, it's like, give me a
flippers,
fucking break.
It's impossible. Yeah.
Except for...
quit contradicting yourself.
If you're in a boat...
snorkel instructor.
With flippers on, you're supposed to go into the water by falling backwards into it.
I never did that. I like the snorkel. I like snorkeling all the time. I always just put them on the ladder. and then I just sort of push myself off the ladder. I'm not bailing out backwards out of a boat. Are you crazy?
Snorkel.
The only time I do that is in Atlanta with our good buddy Chuck. Then I'm jumping out of boats all the time.
Yeah, where Chuck opens up his motorboat as fast as it can go on the lake and you just bail out of the boat to scare him.
I don't know why that became such a bit. I could not let that go. I was like, the one thing I'm going to do is just disappear from the boat. Which is really, like, extremely dangerous.
Yeah, yeah. At night, at dusk, when, like, it will be impossible for another boat to see that you're in the water in front of them.
That's the good stuff right there.
So they head out for this planet, and the first order of business is to see if they can clean up the signal, because it's real mangled. It's a lot of interference, and O'Brien takes on kind of a level of obsession before anyone else with this problem. Like he's really working hard on fixing the signal problems. And
did you get the Brahms tingles from this moment?
Sometimes it feels like she's actually talking to me.
It's not the way this may look.
Why? She reminds me of my cousin.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, like because the doctor comes in and he's like, you know, you can turn that off and it won't change anything about what you're doing. And mm-hmm. I think O'Brien feels comforted, like, having her voice there, though.
It was weird that Cassidy walked in as O'Brien was listening to the part where Captain Lisa was digging and using a trench toilet.
Yeah, and they just make weird eye contact.
Yeah.
Bashir particularly enjoyed part of that.
Bashir was like, well, Class L planet does have a lot of water to drink. I am not so much concerned about her hydration.
Yeah.
As much as her respiration.
I thought it was amazing, like, how hard the work of cleaning the signal up was. Like, O'Brien is, mm-hmm. is in Jeffrey's tubes. He's, like, on his back under computer panels. He's, like, pulling components out and reconfiguring them. This is, like, a major job.
One thing I noticed about this episode right away during all of the scenes of Captain Lisa's dialogue was just how to like the episode. I think you need to get with how that dialogue is, and it feels very performative in a way that initially I didn't mind, but toward the end I was like, where does Captain Lisa get off telling Sisko what to do about his relationship? Like, there was a tone to her that felt like it starts desperate because of her circumstances, but then it pivots into this other weird feeling, which is like it assumes some things about our characters and then gets very intimate with many of our characters, as we'll find out later. But I looked into who wrote the episode, and it was written by an intern. Her name was Pam Pietrafort.
Wow.
She wrote two episodes for Deep Space Nine, was a television intern, and then, as far as I can tell, did not go on to have a career in television. That was it.
Wow. What the hell?
Kind of amazing trivia.
I thought that the episode was really well written and very, like, sensitive and good, and I maybe disagree a little bit with you about the performance. I thought Deborah Wilson's, like, making a character that you can't see was really well done.
You know what it sounded like to me? And this may be a better way to put it than the way I put it before, but it sounded like a video game dialogue in terms of performance and writing, in a way that sounded like a modern video game versus a 90s television show.
Interesting.
That makes sense. It felt like an imperfect fit.
Deborah Wilson does voices for video games now. I actually recently played a game that she was one of the lead voices on, this Star Wars Jedi game. And I...
Well, that's perfect.
I wound up kind of hating the game, but I thought that her character was really good.
I mean, maybe this launched that career for her. That's great.
Are you saying, like, maybe what this was missing more than anything else was, like, a kind of gross, uncanny valley CG character giving a performance for this voice work?
That Geordi could fall in love with? Is that what you're suggesting?
Maybe.
Yes, that's what I'm looking for every time.
I'm guilty of a terrible crime.
She tells the story of her ship's demise, and it sounds pretty rough. There's a planet with a strange energy field, and her ship goes down, and they punch out a bunch of escape pods. Hers is one of them. It crash lands on this planet, and it seems like she's the only survivor. And so it's a race against time. That's what it is.
Yeah, and I thought that they did a great job of, like, establishing and then advancing the stakes of this, but maybe I'm getting ahead of myself. Let's check back in on what's going on with Quark and Odo.
This is one of the great A to B story mismatches on Deep Space Nine, I think.
Yeah,
in
a way that's kind of like classic Trek, that
right.
is like there's the tense, like, emotionally charged A story and the who gives a shit B story.
Yeah.
What Quark has observed in setting up his long con on Odo is that the 1 month anniversary of Odo and Kira's first date is coming up, and Quark is like, hey, Odo, you remember that extremely cringy first date you and Kira had? Don't you want to remember that forever by connecting the memory to an object that you buy Kira?
Did you ever hear of anything so ridiculous?
There's no amount of drinking that can remove that memory from my mind.
I'm half gold, half vodka right now. Look at me. I'm barely holding my shape. I'm so drunk, and I can still only think of that.
It's one of the great manipulations that a person can pull on someone else, is that, remember the time where you did something awful? Just bringing it up.
Yeah. Crucially, Saturday is the 1 month anniversary. So Odo has a little bit of time to find a present, and so he runs off to the gift shop across the promenade, and Jake comes in and is like, what are you up to, Quark? What's this about? And this is where, like, a little negotiation takes place, which I was surprised that money didn't come into.
Right.
Jake kind of plays to Quark's ego and says, like, I'm going to base a character of a nefarious villain on you. Wouldn't that be great? And I thought that it would have been fun if Quark had said, yeah, sounds good. How about five bars?
Right. But instead, he does it for zero bars and wants anything even remotely appearing to be Quark-like to not be in the book. He wants to be anonymized in every way that's in any way that would be interesting.
And he also wants Jake to see him through his own eyes, which is not as a villain up to a scheme, but as a businessman.
The tech industry is an American success story.
Who is looking to do a transaction that would be, you know, frowned upon by the authorities. And in Quark's mind, that's an important distinction to be made.
The main reason I knew that this anniversary was going to go poorly for Odo was that his gift idea is clearly a Pandora necklace. See, this charm is a bucket. So you'll think of me.
This charm is a rocky outcrop in a sea of yellow liquid. And I'm hoping you'll think of me and not Dr. Bashir when you look at that one.
We go around the horn with Captain Lisa. She gets a shift with everyone. That's the job, right?
Yeah, well,
Captain Lisa's like, look, I would...
They clear it up, right? They clear up the connection, and she can suddenly hear them for the first time. That's been O'Brien's problem, is that he wants to, A, clear up the signal, but also have the ability to reply. Because she's kind of losing hope, right? Like, she's been just monologuing into her radio, wishing somebody would hear her distress signal.
It's fixing a problem and creating another one, because as soon as O'Brien gets the radio working and they're able to talk to Captain Lisa, Captain Lisa's like, well, I've been working on some stand-up, and I'm just wondering if I could have a couple of your crew people to just kind of bounce it off to and workshop it with.
I've got a lot of bits in my notebook here, and I'm just going to try stuff, and you tell me what works and what doesn't.
In an extinction-level friendship event, O'Brien foists her onto Bashir almost first to get this out of the way. Pretty great. And she does a bit on Bashir almost right away, where she fakes that she's been eaten by some mystery monster.
Yeah, I love this.
It's getting closer.
What?
I love the extremely Star Trek type speech pattern of the mystery monster that she comes up with, too.
Yeah. There is never a moment where you are falling for this if you're not Dr. Bashir.
Yeah. I wonder, like, because we get a glimpse of a Nausicaan in this episode. I wonder if they showed her some Nausicaan to develop this character.
I bet. Yeah, and that's not the first Nausicaan reference we will get in this episode, because it turns out a Nausicaan is who Quark's doing business with.
Right.
In the B story.
She's a talker, man. This is like your mom's friend that doesn't know how to get off the phone. And now it's a whole
thing with G. I would have pulled a Dr. Bashir. I'm setting the phone down and doing some things, yeah, in my room.
Giving her some perfunctory, yep, uh-huh. Yeah.
This is why my mom's friends are often faking like they've been attacked by wolves during our phone calls.
She's very interested in maintaining this connection, so they're taking shifts.
They got four more detectives working on the case.
And Sisko, I think it's the first one. The conversations she has with Sisko are all about spilling the tea on his relationship with Cassidy, and that's a touchy subject for him right now, because, like, you know, when Cassidy shows up on the bridge, he's getting chilly with her. You know, he's feeling like she's sort of invading his professional space.
This is a very different breed of captain, right? I feel like Captain Picard would hate Captain Lisa.
Totally. But Captain Cusack has, like, some real insight into, like, why it is bothering Sisko that Cassidy is there, you know?
It bothered me when Cassidy Yates asked her a question on the radio in that scene. Like, I bristled up at that. Like, what are you doing? This is Starfleet business.
Yeah.
Also, you're a felon. Like, you're a criminal, Cassidy Yates. You shouldn't have bridge privileges.
She served her debt to society, Adam. If you think that felons shouldn't have the right to vote and shouldn't have the right to be on the bridge of a starship, then you can fucking get the hell out of here.
I think they have the right to vote. I do not believe that they should get bridge privileges.
You think that the second you commit a crime, it's bridge privileges revoked for the rest of your life?
I mean, if I believe that, then I think I also believe that Data shouldn't have been invited back to the bridge after his many crimes. I think that all checks out.
I have a less punishment-oriented philosophy when it comes to criminal justice. I think that people can be reformed.
That's great. That's classic Ben. You know, it's classic Ben turning comedy into virtue. It's the best.
What are you doing?
The O'Brien conversations are all about his, like, dread about the war and weird feelings about having, you know, thought he put that chapter of his life behind him. Because Captain Cusack was the head of a starship that left the Federation eight years ago on a very deep space mission. And so she's kind of checked out of, like, what's going on politically. I thought it would have been natural for somebody to be like, well, so what kind of was going down in the Federation around when you left, you know?
This is an interesting bit of foreshadowing, right? She's so out of touch with the news of the day that, like, it sort of points to the conclusion of the story and what her truth is by the end.
She's like one of those Japanese soldiers that was stationed on an island before the war broke out and didn't have a radio, and then, you know, somebody shows up and they didn't even know that there was a war on.
O'Brien tells Captain Cusack, I don't hate the war, Captain Cusack. I hate what the war made me become. And Captain Cusack's like, that is really profound. You just came up with that on the spot?
I'm sorry, I shouldn't be laying all this on your shoulders, Captain.
O'Brien's like, that's actually material. I kind of say that to a lot of people.
Captain Cusack's like, interesting you brought that up. I actually have some material I've been working on myself.
She's gone.
She tries out her monster attack material on everyone.
She's working on like a horror podcast.
Yeah.
One of the ways that they kind of step up the pressure is that she's got a drug with her called Triox that she needs to be taking in order to survive the thin atmosphere on the planet that she's crashed on. And Bashir has asked her to ration the Triox to a much lower dosage than is recommended in the I Crashed on a Planet guidebook that she brought with her.
This introduces the idea of a timeline, Ben, into this whole thing. We have a diminishing amount of a life-saving drug, an amount of time that the ship is taking to get there. These numbers do not match up in a way that equals a living Captain Cusack at the end.
Right. They've got 3 days to get there, and she's got 2 more days of drug, and that means they're going to have to do something to speed up. They're going to have to find a way to go from 9 to 9.5, and that means using reserve power for the structural integrity field, which, against Worf's objections, they decide to borrow from the phaser reserves.
If Sulu were on the ship, he'd say fly her apart.
I know. Where was Sulu to advise on this?
Someone should have suggested the Sulu maneuver.
That would have been great.
Yeah. But this is like deep, deep trivia on the Little D, though, right? Like, this was always the story of the Little D.
Yeah.
Is that, like, it will fly itself apart if it has to. It's over-engineered.
It's got too much engine for the chassis that they gave it.
Sweet!
And so, yeah, they make the decision to step on it, add that last little bit of NOS to the fuel mixture.
This is an awkward moment for Cassidy to enter the scene, because she's like, hey, guys, what's going on?
How's it going?
And then gets totally shut down by Ben Sisko here.
I don't think so.
I guess I'll see you later.
Right.
Again, like, a lot of this reminds me of the Wesley Crusher problem. Again, like, who's allowed on the bridge and who isn't?
Yeah.
Especially if you are a relation to a bridge officer in the way that she sort of is.
It also feels like she's not coming on with, like, business to conduct. I'm on a cruise and there are no locked doors to me because I'm the captain's girlfriend.
It's the podcast problem of if the door to your office is open, people are going to enter.
Yeah. Like, a starship captain is going to have fucking tough times at work, some challenging moments on the bridge.
This is a moment that Ben Sisko shares with Captain Cusack, because Captain Cusack is someone that believes strongly that mixing the personal and the professional is no bueno.
Yeah.
Well, aren't there times when you come home at the end of the day and you're just like, if I see one more cup of coffee.
She's a firm believer in setting boundaries.
Which is funny coming from her, who is so probing in every conversation.
Yeah. She's very intense. In many ways, she's a lot like my wife. She's not going to let an issue drop if it comes up.
Back on the station, Quark and, for some reason, Jake are inspecting the goods in the cargo bay. And Quark is lamenting the idea of not being able to sell them. It's a scheduling conflict, right? If Odo isn't going to be distracted by his date on the same day that he has made arrangements with this Nausicaan, the deal's not going to happen. And that, at this point, is the status of things.
Odo has kind of unilaterally decided, I'm not going to celebrate the one-month anniversary of our first date. That sucked. I'm going to celebrate the one-month anniversary of our first kiss. That ruled. And this has completely fucked Quark's shit up, because the Nausicaan is expecting a Saturday delivery of the crystals, and he can't get back in touch with the guy until he reaches the station. But if Odo is on duty when this dude gets to the station,
we'll both be in a holding cell faster than you can say criminal conspiracy.
And I think Jake's bummed too, because he wanted to see this deal go down.
Mm-hmm. And he wanted a surprising, late in career, successful rap duo with Quark called Sell the Jewels.
For some reason, his book was depending on this moment.
Yeah.
We get one of the classic Odo reveals at the end of this scene. An almost season one Odo reveal of where you are reminded once again, like, why don't they search the room? If you're a criminal on the station, searching the room is the first thing you do.
Yeah.
Search for Odo.
Well, and it's a mechanic that we've gotten a lot of development of over the mm-hmm. seasons, right? Like, what about if they'd come into the cargo bay and, like, swept with a wide beam phaser at a very low intensity to see if any of the barrels turn into Odos?
Right.
But this is unlike season one, Odo turns from barrel to man and is quite touched by something that Quark has said, because Quark is like, yeah, it's a shame we can't sell these fucking crystals. Like, I really wanted to. It was going to be a great come up for me. Technically, it's illegal. And you would think, after all I've done for Odo, all of the wonderful things I've done for that man, that he would cut me some fucking slack once. But no.
Right. There's like two prongs to this lamentation by Quark, though. He's sad about his missed opportunity, but it's also the knowledge that he will be arrested, because once the plan has been put into motion, there's no stopping it. Like, the Nausicaan's coming to the station expecting to do a deal that can't be done, and then Quark and the Nausicaan will be arrested for the deal that doesn't happen.
I was really looking forward to that happening, but instead, Odo's quite touched by what Quark said. I don't really know what we can point to as things Quark has done for Odo. Odo believes it, and that's what's important.
Odo is in fog of love, though.
Yeah.
Fog of new love, especially. And that can make you act a little bit irrationally.
True.
As we'll find out later.
True indeed.
Morn.
Dear sweet.
Morn. You near, buddy?
Morn.
Stop. Hammer time.
We get Odo in a tux and Kira in a very fetching flapper dress haircut combo.
Yeah, are they going back to some kind of 1920s hang, or are they heading to the Vic Fontaine era? Because she's not really Vic Fontaine appropriate in that costume, is she?
It's got to be uncomfortable every time they do this, and Ben Sisko's like, of all the time periods, you're choosing then? What are you trying to say about me?
Yeah. Very hurtful.
I wouldn't like that at all if I were Ben Sisko.
Might make a station-wide regulation about it.
It's the kind of club I feel the most comfortable in. I can't put my finger on why.
Jesus.
That's some dark shit.
If I was Odo, the kind of club I would want to go to would be the club in Blade, where the sprinklers open up and spray liquid all over the party people.
Oh yeah, Club Bashir. Yeah. That's what you're talking about. Where the water is always warm.
On the little D, they finally get to this planet, and it's coated in a shell of Metrion radiation. I feel like it gets pronounced a couple of different ways. Metrion or Metrion, depending on who's saying it. But it seems to be sort of maybe similar in a lot of ways to chroniton radiation.
Oh, and we know what that means.
Yeah.
It's time travel.
They can't beam through this, so they're going to have to go down in a shuttlecraft. I don't think they say it in the episode, but in the Wikipedia article about this episode, it says that the name of the shuttlecraft is the Chafee.
Really? Yeah,
named after failed Democratic presidential candidate Lincoln Chafee.
Is not.
No, I don't think it probably is, but I like to imagine it is.
This felt like a new comp and a new launch.
Yeah, and a new kind of shuttle pod.
I didn't know Little D had this orifice.
Yeah, opens up out of the bottom.
It's in between the nacelles and the deflector dish.
It's a grundle pod. And Sisko goes himself, takes the doctor and Chief O'Brien with him. The doctor, because they may need to provide medical interventions for this lady, and Chief O'Brien because he is hopelessly in love with her, I guess.
Yeah, he's a little overly excited about being a part of this mission.
Yeah. So they punch through this weird energy barrier around the planet. They get down, and I really liked the establishing shots of the planet itself. This was great. Like, it looked like maybe they made a real like model of the planet and then comped a digital shuttlecraft into it.
It was foreshadowed a little bit by Captain Cusack's own comments. When she crash landed on the planet, she mentioned that it looked like a real piece of shit planet, like Ferenginar, like a place that you'd never be comfortable in.
Yeah.
It also brought up another question, Ben, like, where is the Federation poncho?
Oh, yeah.
Like, isn't a Starfleet poncho the perfect thing to wear on an away mission like this?
That would have been nice. It would have been nice to have.
Because these guys are getting soaked.
Yeah, and even underground, like, she's been hiding out in caves, and they go into the Star Trek caves where she's been transmitting from. They're, like, having trouble. They're not picking up on life signs. And even somehow underground, the rain is getting in there and raining all over them.
It made me wonder about that Star Trek caves playset. If you bring in the rain machine in there,
yeah,
how long is it before those caves are usable again after it dries? Are there floor drains in the Star Trek cave?
I don't know. Yeah, like that. Like, I had no idea that that was a wet set capable standing set.
When we're constructing a Star Trek cave, you're going to want to put down some crushed rock before you layer a sand over the top.
This is what's called a French drain, and in any wet set environment, it's crucial for proper drainage. We're also using an array of synthetic materials to make these rocks and outcroppings so that they don't absorb water at all.
We get a classic high voice concern Sisko here.
This has to be the only direction she could have been headed in.
This is a quality of Sisko that we've been getting more and more. When he's worried about someone, he goes up another octave.
Yeah.
When he yells out for Captain Cusack.
And unfortunately, they find her quite dead. Somehow she found a dry enough part of the cave to be very dried out.
Sisko rolls her body over and he's like, ugh. It's like one of those Ferengi body pucks, just totally desiccated. O'Brien's like, sick.
Like a dead cat you find in somebody's garage.
Yeah, dead for 3 years is Captain Cusack.
It's tragic. She's way deader than they thought she was going to be. They thought she might be somewhat dead. They thought, like, maybe we've got, like, 20, 30 minutes to get her back to the shuttle and then back to Six Bay because she's been suffering from hypoxia for so long. But she's super-duper dead.
Yeah.
And that is to do with the Metrion radiation. They figure out what's been happening is that she's been transmitting through that energy field, and it's been jumping forward in time 3 years, and then they've been transmitting back, and it's been jumping back in time 3 years.
Which accounts for her questions about the state of Starfleet.
Right.
If she was 3 years in the past, it sort of makes the nature of her questions more reasonable.
Right.
It seemed like she was pretty out of touch at the time, but now you know why.
Right. It's 8 plus 3 is what she is, how out of sync she was with the latest news. And like, I think that that's like also like a short enough span. Like if it was like, if she was in like a TOS movie uniform with the flap with the blood on it, like, I think it would have made a lot less sense, because they would have been like, yeah, like, we're at war with the Cardassians and the Jem'Hadar. And she'd be like, what's a Cardassian? You know?
Sisko's like, well, they're like craggy looking people with sort of a spoon head look about them.
She'd be like, wow, that...
real squirrely looking guys.
You sound like pretty xenophobic describing them, to be honest. Like, different aliens have different loaf, Sisko. What's your problem?
I'm xenophobic. I've got my own crew people vacationing in the 1920s. There are problems all around me, Captain Cusack.
The Federation is really falling apart.
Far worse than is generally known.
They bring Captain Cusack's remains back with them and throw what is called an Irish wake for her back on the station in the wardroom. Dax describes what the basics are of an Irish wake to Worf, who's never encountered this concept before.
It's a way to memorialize the death and celebrate life at the same time.
And he's very impressed. He says it sounds almost Klingon.
A lot less screaming, though, probably. Unclear whether or not Captain Cusack is going to Stovacor. She's probably not, if they didn't scream for her.
Yeah.
How would Stovacor know to expect a warrior was coming?
Well, I don't know if she was a warrior. I think she was more of an explorer.
Yeah.
Crucially, this is not an open torpedo Irish wake.
Yeah, I mean, I could not take my eyes off of the base for the torpedo either. Mm-hmm. Very top heavy was this whole situation, and at many times during the scene, people were laying hands on it. Great big wobble on the torpedo stand here. I was expecting one of those like fun funeral comedy scenes where the torpedo falls open and the body spills out.
Yeah, yeah.
And Grandma clutches her pearls.
Yeah, because O'Brien is looking in there and he's like, "Is that my putter?
That club's irreplaceable. It's 10 years old. They don't make it anymore."
I'm so sorry.
And then he makes Bashir go to his car and get one of his golf clubs to swap in for it. And
right.
at the wake, Sisko goes up to Cassidy and says, "Hey, like later on, there's actually something I really want to talk to you about, but not here, not now." And she says, "Is this about me?" And he says, "No, it's actually about me." And it's one of those like, I like see me after class. That's like more. A greater amount of emotional violence than is actually meant by it.
Oh, yeah. I was absolutely nauseated by this scene, just because of how many times I've been on both ends of this.
Totally.
Like, don't do this, Ben Sisko. If you want to have a conversation later, have the conversation later, but don't say, "We need to talk."
I want to have you stew about this for 3 or 4 hours before we actually hash it out.
To Cassidy Yates' credit, she takes it with great aplomb. Like, she is
seriously
cooler than anyone could possibly be about this rhetorical bomb dropped into her lap. I was scared for her.
Yeah.
And then the eulogies are kicked off by Dr. Bashir in a classic throwback to season one Dr. Bashir, because he makes his eulogy all about himself.
"I am not the arrogant, self-absorbed, godlike doctor that I appear to be on occasion."
I love this.
Yeah. He's like, "I would like to propose a toast. There's a bottle going around, one of my private collection."
Cut to Worf, and he's just like power pounding it.
A warrior's beverage. I thought that this was sweet, though. Like, they all formed a relationship with her. O'Brien's comments about, like I never even, like, met her in person, but she meant a lot to me. And I thought a lot about, like, the fact that these characters are all at war right now. Mm-hmm. And this is a funeral, which is got to be like a fairly commonplace thing that they are dealing with, like semi-weekly probably, but this is a kind of funeral that feels separate from that and might be kind of a way for them to access a simpler time in an interesting way.
Which is why they're all drinking Simple Times. The tone of this felt very much like All Good Things. They're all looking at each other, imagining a future where one of them isn't there.
Mm-hmm.
And Cusack is the one that has made them confront that idea. Even though none of them knew her really, she inspired this sort of appreciation among them in a way that felt very like that last episode of TNG. I was not expecting the gravity of this moment, the way that we got it.
Yeah.
Thought it was well done.
Indeed. Did you like the episode, though?
You really want to do this here, now? Okay, let's do it!
I don't like that we don't go to dinner with Cassidy and Pan Sisko later. How is he going to fix this?
Yeah.
That's a bigger cliffhanger than Best of Both Worlds Part 1, I think.
When this is over, I want to talk to you about something. Something that's been on my mind.
I have a rich history of teachers telling me to see them after class.
You know what the best thing was when a teacher asked you to stay after class and then they forgot that they asked you to stay after class and then you just sort of go on to the next period and you really get away with one in that moment. Did that ever happen to you?
No, my teachers always remembered.
Oh, shit.
My teachers were like Pepperidge Farm, man.
To answer your question, I did not love this episode, aside from its ending. It felt very derivative of that Data and Sarjinka pen pals episode from TNG, the voice in the distance that you're trying to go save. It felt a little bit like a retread in that way, in a way that's unfortunate. What about you, Ben?
I can certainly see the parallels there, but I liked that she was a Federation starship captain of a ship that was on a mission of exploration. Like, her uniform when they find her body is like old time pre-first contact TNG uniform. Mm-hmm. And I loved just remembering that. I think that it was like a really like shrewd episode to put toward the end of season 6 of remember before this all happened, like what Starfleet was about. And I don't think it's like one of the strongest episodes of the season by any extent, but I kind of liked it for that reason. Like, I kind of like the song order decision that they made with putting an episode like this where it is.
I like being reminded that this is a mission that Starfleets have got to be doing all the time.
Totally.
The rescue mission and the race against time feels like that's what Kobayashi Maru is. That's like a foundational mission if you're an officer, and it's good to be reminded of such a thing.
Yeah. Do you want to be reminded of how great our listeners are by checking our Priority One inbox?
Oh, I'm already there. I beat you there, Ben.
Oh, shit.
Priority One message from Starfleet coming in on secured channel.
Need a supplemental income.
Supplemental income?
Supplemental.
Supplemental.
Yeah, it's extra.
By the interest alone, could be enough to buy this ship.
We've got two Priority One messages this week, both of them personal. The first one, Ben, is from Dan. And it is to you and me. I'm going to assume it's you and me because it says Ben and Adam.
Could be a different Ben and Adam.
Message goes like this. Hey, Adam. Hey, Ben. Thanks for making TGG. Have some scarves.
Nice.
That's it. Requested date is any Deep Space Nine ep other than Time's Orphan.
Wow.
Which is an interesting request. Like, Dan, what do you have against Time's Orphan, out of curiosity?
Or is like Time's Orphan too sacred to Dan to use as a jokey message?
I'm filled with both gratitude and more questions for Dan. Thanks for the scarves, Dan.
Yeah. We also have a message here from Charles. First paragraph of message is this old Enterprise, of course. That's Charles's name. And it is also to Ben and Adam, and it goes like this. When constructing the galaxy's finest pod, start with two hosts of pure moose knuckle. They are in a waifu-crazed genocidal deity and the finest drops in the biz. Top off with a clear coat of thirst for nose ridges, and this pod will last for generations. Thanks for helping keep me smiling and sane, now and always.
Hey, that's great.
Thanks, Charles.
I like hearing our friends at This Old House describe our show thusly.
Well, if you'd like to send us a P1, we'd sure appreciate it. It's $100 for a personal message and $200 for a commercial message, and they're a great way to support the production of our show. Hey, Adam.
What's that, Ben?
Did you find yourself a drunk Shimoda?
Incredible.
Drunk Shimoda!
Yeah, I got a time code Shimoda for you.
Time code Shimoda.
At about 7:54, we get an establishing shot of Quark's bar, and everyone knows that when you're shooting a thing, like, you call action,
yeah,
and that's when, like, the scene begins. But before that, you call background action, essentially, like, you, because you don't want people to start their move
right
after the scene begins, right? And so there's nothing unusual production-wise about this moment, but the guy that we see with the first move in this scene looks like a normal guy, like a 1998 guy wearing a flannel shirt and just like drinking a beer.
Yeah, they got that shirt at like The Gap.
Yeah, it looks contextually of the time that the show was made. It looks like he's trying to sneak off the set before the scene actually begins.
Yeah, everything about him does look like he's from the 90s, except for the green space drink he's drinking.
He looks like he's a time traveler, and he caught my eye so utterly that I'm going to make him my Shimoda. Regular guy alert, Ben.
Wow.
What about you?
I also have a regular guy alert, and if you look at 1 minute and 16 seconds into this episode, this is like right after Odo's been distracted from busting Quark's chops by his new girlfriend Kira, and he you know, puts his arm around her shoulder and walks down the promenade with her. A new patron enters Quark's bar. This patron appears to be a Jem'Hadar in civilian clothing.
What? What are you doing here, Jem'Hadar?
How are you walking around?
One Ketracel White, please.
Sorry, sir. We're fresh out. I can look in the basement, but I'm pretty sure we're totally spoken for on Jem'Hadar White.
Another notable thing about this scene is we've got a Snuffleupagus trunk alien playing Dabo.
Oh, yeah, I saw that.
The trunk head.
Yeah, the trunk head shows up a couple of times in different scenes, but
yeah.
That Jem'Hadar, like, and I don't...
Weird.
I was looking for the Jem'Hadar every time we come back to Quark's bar, which is a number of times in this episode, and I didn't see them again, but I'm almost positive that that's Jem'Hadar Loaf.
I mean, you're not going to kick out a paying customer, are you?
I guess not.
I mean, his latinum is as good as anyone's.
That's true, yeah. That's my drunk Shimoda. What's that guy doing there?
We may never know.
Gotta get that gold press latinum. Get that gold press latinum. Am I right?
Mother's Day is coming up, and one of the best gifts you can give a mom that you might share a bed with is doing some yard work downstairs, if you know what I mean, with Manscaped. This season, make sure you groom your carpets and your drapes with the leader in below-the-waist grooming. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code SCARVES at manscaped.com. That's 20% off and free shipping with the code SCARVES at manscaped.com. Nothing like a little spring cleaning in your pants to let the mother of your children know how much you appreciate her continuing to put up with you. Are you looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life? Aura frames are beautiful Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. Every mom I have ever given an Aura frame to has absolutely loved it, and that includes a lot of moms I know. This is a gift that I have personally given many times, and
It's great. I can upload photos from my phone the moment I take them, and that means that mom or grandma out there is going to get pictures of their loved ones delivered to their living room. And right now, Aura is having a great sale for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting auraframes.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's auraframes.com and use the code SCARVS at checkout to show your support for our show. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, when you listen to podcasts, it really just comes down to whether or not you like the sound of everyone's voices. My voice is one of the sounds you'll hear on the podcast Dr. Game Show, and this is the voice of co-host and fearless leader Joe Firestone.
This is a podcast where we play games submitted by listeners, and we play them with callers over Zoom we've never spoken to in our lives. So that is basically the concept of the show. Pretty chill.
So take it or leave it, bucko. And here's what some of the listeners have to say.
It's funny, wholesome, and it never fails to make me smile.
I just started listening and I'm already binging it. I haven't laughed this hard in ages. I wish I'd discovered it sooner.
You can find Dr. Game Show on MaximumFun.org.
Video games can make you laugh.
They can make you cry.
They can even make you sing.
We're the hosts of Triple Click.
It's a podcast about video games.
This is an exciting time for new games, from Diablo to Final Fantasy.
From Starfield to Street Fighter.
From Zelda to... oh, who are we kidding? We're just going to talk about Zelda.
Whether you play games or you just like hearing about them, we've got you covered.
Find us at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Bye.
One thing we know for sure is that there is an episode after this one.
Yeah, you want to head to the Game of Buttholes, the Will of the Prophets at gach.biz/game.
I'm there right now, Ben. I'm here to tell you that we are currently on square 40. In the deep, deep distance is a Coco Nono ep.
Ooh, shit.
You would have to roll a 6 to get us there. So,
well, it's your roll, my friend. And
shit.
That's a rare roll for you to roll a 6.
It'll never happen, right?
But the episode in question is season 6, episode 26, Tears of the Prophets. Ignoring the warnings of the prophets, Sisko leads an invasion into Dominion territory.
He's just driving people crazy with what he chooses to accept and deny about his role as the Sisko.
It's complicated. Well, how are we going to be watching that particular episode, Adam?
You're required to learn as you play. Roll.
I'm gonna roll. Everyone back off! I'm gonna roll! I have rolled a 4.
Chula!
Did I win?
Hardly.
Which puts us on square 44. Just 2 away from a Coco Nono, which means we're gonna watch the season finale of season 6, Stone Cold Sober.
44 is the channel number of KBHK, the channel I watched Star Trek on when I was a boy.
How about that?
Yeah.
God, in Seattle, I believe it was KSTW 11, channel 11 was what it was on.
So 44, a multiple of 11.
Of interest to everyone are those pieces of trivia.
Yeah. You know that people from the Bay Area and Seattle are just going like, yeah! Anyways.
Just tearing out their earbuds in triumph.
Yeah,
at the shout out.
I mean, we give people a lot of reasons to tear out their earbuds on this show, Adam, but that's actually a positive one.
It's nice, right?
You know what else is nice? All of the kind folks that support us at MaximumFun.org/join. If you're listening to this the week it comes out, last week to get in on that sweet, sweet Max Fun Drive, get those cool pledge gifts. But if you're not, just support us, you know? Supporting us any time of year is a good time of year. Max Fun Drive just happens to be the best time of year.
It helps keep the show going. Couldn't do it without you.
We sure couldn't. We got to thank our buddy Bill Tilly, who has gone from being our card daddy to being our social media daddy. He runs the Greatest Trek Instagram and Twitter accounts, and we really appreciate all of the hard and thoughtful work he does doing that.
Give him / us a follow over on the Twitter and the Instagram, why don't you?
While you're following social media things, how about following Adam Ragusea's YouTube channel? He's the musical genius that made all of the custom interstitial and background music for this show. He, of course, worked off of the prior art of Dark Materia, but now Adam Ragusea is on to bigger and better things as a great big YouTube cooking celebrity. And his channel is great. It's going to teach you all kinds of good recipes.
I am looking outside of my window and seeing two thriving tomato plants, thanks to a couple of the things I learned from Adam Ragusea's YouTube page. So it's about food, but also about growing tomatoes.
Hell yeah. Listen to our other shows on Maximum Fun. We do The Greatest Discovery. I think as of the release of this episode, we'll be going to be pretty close to the launch of our episodes covering Star Trek : Lower Decks, the animated series.
That's right. This episode is coming out the week of episode one of Lower Decks. So get into that. Watch Lower Decks and then get into all of our fun programming over at The Greatest Discovery.
And also listen to Friendly Fire, a war movie podcast that isn't as bad as that makes it sound.
With that, we'll be back at you next time with another great episode of Star Trek Deep Space Nine and an episode of The Greatest Generation that may come back without one of its hosts.
Oh, shit. Recast the time after that, huh?
Yep.
Wow.
Who's going to play me? Oh, you have ideas. Don't even pretend that you don't.
Somebody younger, but no less appealing.
Good luck trying to find anyone as type A as me. No such thing as type A+.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.